Greetings, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast. I'm excited to share this one with you. My guest is Jennifer Clarer. She is the partner and head of cell and gene therapy at the Dedham Group, a New York City-based oncology and specialty therapeutics strategy consulting firm. She and I are going to cover a lot of ground regarding pricing and value for cell and gene therapies. But before we do, Jen, thanks for your time on Cell and Gene, the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. Okay. All right. I want to start out by first getting a better understanding of what is the Dedham Group and why have you personally decided to focus on cell and gene therapy? Also, how does the Dedham Group support the cell and gene therapy industry or sector as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Dedham Group is a boutique strategy consulting firm. We're very focused in specialty therapeutics from an access and commercial perspective. Cell and gene therapy thereby became a natural progression of the organization, but I personally, I did graduate research in an autologous cell therapy and critical limb ischemia. I have a very deep passion for this space. And as we started to commercialize cell and gene products, particularly in the US market, I was lucky enough to get involved very early. And that ultimately became my preferred specialization. I've worked across many other, oncology, immunology, rare disease categories before with other types of therapeutics. I think what else was pretty interesting about cell and gene that really drew me to this space was that it's a big transition for our healthcare system to move from disease management to disease resolution. And there isn't a lot of infrastructure today that well supports that type of transition, from a billing and coding perspective. Even we'll get into a number of reasons for that, but I wanted to be part of how do you make our very complex healthcare ecosystem easier to navigate for such a novel type of therapeutic category that very much differs from other modalities. At the Dedham Group, we, as I mentioned, support access and commercial operation strategies. Typically, we may get involved a bit in phase one in cell and gene and then definitely continue through post-launch, usually supporting strategic recommendations across payer coverage and reimbursement, including pricing, contracting, provider site adoption and utilization, distribution and patient services, and order fulfillment and field team activities. So it's definitely been a really exciting time in the industry to be a part of answering a lot of those big questions and helping organizations navigate, how you can take a product from bench, all the way to the patient through that lens of access and commercial operations.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that detailed background information. And certainly a really important conversation and quite honestly, one that what we're about to delve into really haven't covered on Cell and Gene, the podcast yet. So I'm really looking forward to getting into this. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, what do you find to be some of the most important aspects of launching a cell or gene therapy that can be overlooked? And maybe some of the approaches to enhancing or maintaining continued access post-launch.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think there hasn't been enough attention on the degree of impact that market access has on cell and gene therapy success. Honestly, oftentimes I think because the clinical achievements for especially these earliest cell and gene products, they're monumental. And they do, by extension, become a big focus of pharma leadership. And sometimes there can be this assumption that utilization will follow, right? A lot of the categories cell and gene products are addressing they're rare, they're very high need, they're urgent to treat. But unfortunately, our healthcare ecosystem is not that easy to navigate for a normal product, for a standard patient to move through. So that's, of course, only exacerbated by introducing this novel therapeutic journey that's often associated with cell and gene products. So, in a nutshell, for cell and gene therapy developers to adequately obtain access, commercialize product, you need evolved infrastructure and cross-stakeholder engagement, essentially, beyond reproducible and scalable manufacturing, which frankly is its own battle, and I don't work as closely in that space. You need a novel distribution and support model structure. So for example, with distributor contracting and relationship setup, we had the introduction of flash title transfer to avoid unnecessary financial accountabilities across different parties. You have specialty pharmacies having a unique involvement in the treatment journey with a sometimes referred to as a drive-by model, a very quick movement of product, right? So there isn't stocking usually seen here, maybe in a future state. And from a support service perspective, now there's oftentimes support for transportation, lodging, meals, things that will enable a patient to get to one of the select sites that may be certified to offer product, may not be close to home, and potentially stay there for an extended period of time. So having a good handle on the novel distribution and support infrastructure, patient support infrastructure that may be needed to launch a product is incredibly important to start thinking about very early in your commercial planning. Additionally, you need very coordinated commercial operations. So you may need to have cross-functional roles or just different types of roles that can engage the many different departments at a provider site that can be involved in product handling and administration. There is definitely this cross-department coordination at play in cell and gene, and oftentimes that responsibility falls on the manufacturer to get all of those different parties that may be involved in that patient journey up to speed on how to handle product. And also helping to define what are the right times for communication across those different departments. And rightfully so. I mean, these are some of the first products that include a provider site very early in the supply chain, before product ultimately comes back for administration. Another big category to be prepared for is enhanced provider site support, right? So site certification and unique trade agreement contracting is something that's more or less unique to this space. You have to ensure that there's clarity at the provider site on all the steps in the journey, but also what is reimbursable across that journey. So they're prepared to financially manage their cell and gene program. And as mentioned before, you do need cross-department coordination. So making sure that there's clarity as to when that has to happen, right? All of those are components of training to launch a product. And then, okay, so we've talked through novel distribution and support models. We've talked through coordinated commercial operations, provider site activation. And the other big component is elevated payer engagement. So in the US alone, we have well over 300 payer entities, and they're subdivided at the plan level. So now you add in the complexity of these products. They're new. It can be sometimes more difficult to be fluent in them as a payer, and it requires differentiated education, right? So, for example, whenever you're dealing with a more expensive product class, there can be an interest in kind of taking your clinical trial criteria. So, rather than just reviewing the FDA label, taking that clinical trial criteria and using that as part of your coverage policy. So, there is a need to have clarity on what's truly appropriate clinical criteria versus potentially unnecessarily limiting access by more or less copy and pasting some standard control criteria from a clinical trial that may not really be indicative of who's likely to respond and how well. And also through the payer lens, they need to be prepared for what are your reimbursable steps, so that they can go into those provider discussions on reimbursement prepared. And beyond this as well, we see the introduction of innovative payment models. So that's another thing that you can engage with payers sometimes quite early pre-launch. I think one of the big things though to take away from this, that at least that I take away from this, what's been particularly impactful is with the Dedham Group, one of the things that's our claim to fame is we have really comprehensive voice of customers. We have this incredible panel of highly knowledgeable folks across each of these channels. And by nature of us being third party, we're able to have very candid discussions with them about the issues that they experience, through each of those core components, distribution, operations, provider, and patient and payer dynamics. So we get to learn a lot more about the behind the scenes workings, what has worked well, what hasn't worked well, where they see things going in the next couple of years, where they're investing to evolve operations. And what is promising is that this is an industry that's just starting to get experience in the market. So I do feel confidently that we're just at the beginning. We're just scratching the surface. So where we'll be able to take the healthcare system to make these things a little bit easier, I'm hopeful for. And it's definitely going to be in our future to kind of hopefully simplify or at least smooth out a lot of those different steps in launching a product.
Good. I'm so glad to hear you say that you're hopeful and that, our experience to date will only help us progress because it is an incredibly complex infrastructure, which of course you just outlined. And so, all of that is to say, I'm glad to hear that you do feel hopeful for the future. Because like I said, it's a lot to kind of wrap your head around. So we've seen, speaking of that, so we've seen, delayed time to treating a first patient or a slowness in initial adoption misaligning with product forecasts. And so I'm curious to know what trends are driving this delay in utilization of post-approval and what experience can emerging biotechs learn from to, ultimately improve that time to treat.
Yes, absolutely. Great question. So, first of all, and I think one thing that's important to know about what the delay in utilization tends to look like, there's going to be a ramp-up period for any new cell or gene product that is not indicative of market value or opportunity in the slightest. Especially in the US market, you need payers to develop coverage policies that clarify who's considered eligible, right? That takes time to release, even up to maybe 6 months or more. You need provider sites to complete that activation process, training, as we talked about earlier, getting the right contracts in place so that they can actually offer product. And some of those steps can't be done until post-approval once you have that FDA label. Provider sites can, they also need to contract with distributors or otherwise be able to purchase products too, maybe even establish a new credit line because we're dealing with totally different price points for these products. Sometimes, though, that can happen pre-approval, but it's important to definitely have in place it. You can't get product without that step. And then on top of that, you'll see a ramp up because providers need to gain experience and comfort with a new product. Patients need to gain comfort and confidence in using a new technology on their disease state. And then furthermore, within each of the individual patient journeys, they're elongated much more upfront as well for these products. So there's going to be time needed for genetic or other confirmatory diagnostic tests that may be required. You have to travel to and from a site of care. You may live kind of far away. You need time to coordinate the affordability of that travel and the travel itself. And I think one of the most important components here is that there has to be time for the provider site to confirm with the payer this patient journey is covered and reimbursement is covered. Particularly reimbursement, because appropriate payment for product and services is often a big question with some of these therapies, especially if they're administered in the inpatient setting. Our current healthcare infrastructure and our payment rates aren't often reflective of these novel types of therapeutics. They're reflective of what's been experienced for years and years in given episodes of care. So, when you add those things together, it can result in a decent amount of time sometimes until a patient's able to receive product. And that doesn't even include the manufacturing time for product, right? Everything that I just mentioned. And some things can happen in parallel, of course. And that's an art in itself that manufacturers often have to prepare for when they're launching a product. But another dynamic that's really important to understand here is that in biologics, right, and in immunotherapy in general, so outside of the cell and gene space, and they've been around for over 20 years. We still see provider sites that tend to be a little bit more financially sensitive. Sometimes there are community practice settings or other types of hospitals. They'll wait until coding is finalized, maybe even 6 months post-approval or more, or they'll, start to use product a bit and see what that reimbursement looks like before they go fully down that road. So when now you have a therapeutic class that's at a totally different price scale, and you may be concentrating that entire treatment journey in one or a select few doses versus spreading that cost over time. Of course, that's going to result in delays, even at your most sophisticated hospitals sometimes, right? Even ones that have had a decent amount of experience with cell and gene, because that's a big financial risk to take. It's not only the product, it's all of the services that surround that treatment journey. So I think we can, as an industry, expect this to normalize over time as more experience is gained and provider sites gain a little bit more fluency in how to navigate that reimbursement journey and feel more confident in reimbursement. But those are some of the things that were just very early in the cell and gene environment. And I think some of the scrutiny on time to treat their first patient is, this market context hopefully will help with that because it makes complete sense. And it is something that we'll definitely see get better with future manufacturers that come to market.
Yeah, good. Okay. And I want to actually expand on that point regarding manufacturing and manufacturers a little bit more. Given how steep launch readiness needs are for large pharma, let alone a pre-revenue biotech, how can manufacturers get ahead of addressing time to treatment issues typically that are typically experienced at launch?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what some manufacturers have done really well is integrating commercial planning a lot earlier in the product life cycle, right? So again, those are the dynamics I'm referring to are your payer, pricing, provider, distribution, services, operations. Having an idea, maybe even a little bit more lightly, phase one, until you have that more formal clinical confirmation. Yes, we're moving on to phase two, but just having that plan initially in phase one, what is going to be expected? How do I make sure that I'm gathering enough resources to support the product launch and invest in this infrastructure being developed? So usually we'll get involved a bit in phase one and then a lot more so in phase two from a strategic planning perspective. And pre-launch, the things that need to have movement are site identification. So where do you want your product to enter the market and how does that phase over time? Because there's only so many resources. You can only activate so many centers early. That has to be done over time. So where do you want to start? Who are the stakeholders that you have to talk to at those sites and what do they need to know, right? So what's the education need? You also have to go through a number of coding applications and start the discussion with payers about your therapeutic area, that you can expect this novel product to enter the space and why is it needed. Very early, you also want to think about how do you design a distribution model and any contracting that maybe needs to happen in a pre-launch environment. Also early thinking about affordability support, genetic testing, coverage, things that you kind of need to start thinking about what's the infrastructure and how much financially am I going to need to contribute to that infrastructure. And then other things are really important pre-launch, going to talk to the provider site, seeing are they interested in adopting at launch, post-launch, having above brand discussions and kind of where they fall. Potentially that can be based on clinical trial experience, but it doesn't have to be. And then of course, pricing and contracting needs to be done pre-launch, that strategy. And then post-launch, these activities definitely continue, but there's some steps that can't be done pre-launch. As mentioned, sometimes the FDA label is a critical step to getting the right training in order. It goes back to some of the earlier points that I was speaking about, but hopefully that provides a little bit of clarity on the activity that someone really needs to be thinking about a little bit earlier before they anticipate their product getting approval.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. That does provide an immense amount of clarity. Thank you. I want to circle back to the role of pricing in cell and gene therapy launch, the discussion of overall value. What is your perspective on the most, say, misunderstood aspects of cell and gene therapy pricing and value? And how do you expect this to evolve in the near term?
Yeah. So I may have a little bit more of a controversial perspective transparently on this, but I do feel that the scrutiny on pricing, launch pricing in the category, has been a little bit short-sighted. And I also do kind of look at it as anti-innovation when there's direct comparisons to what has the cost been in that therapeutic category and what am I offsetting? I think they're valuable questions to ask, and in a future state, they may be more important. But as it stands, these are monumental clinical advancements, and the degree of scientific investment to get to this point and failures to get to this point that precede these launches are extreme, and the costs of developing these products are extreme. And then we just talk through all the activities that are required to actually enable access to them. So I do think there's a gap in understanding of how much work it takes, how much manpower, frankly, it takes to bring cell and gene products to market. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, cell and gene products can be thought of like space age technology. If you talk to somebody that's outside of the industry and you say, oh, yes, we do have cures for some cancers, it's unbelievable, right? Or some rare diseases, right? So, you know, I think there's that dynamic here, but also they're still very extremely expensive to produce. You know, just for context, like there are some cell-based therapies that we work on, they can cost $400 to $500,000 to make per dose, right, for a given patient. And that's not how it's always going to be, but it's so new and we're moving so fast in the category that it's going to take time for us to kind of mellow out some of the investment costs in this field. You know, we're just in its infancy. So I do think that's important context that sits behind this. And, you know, luckily, a lot of these products are launching into rarer conditions. So there should be healthcare dollars here that can afford it. But, you know, another important dynamic is that some of the issues that tend to be raised about value, you know, manufacturing reproducibility, the efficacy, toxicity questions, a lot of those questions are going to be null and void in 5 to 10 years. Like those types of questions about value are actively evolving as well. So I would anticipate the conversation around what constitutes value and how to think about pricing to change radically over time, just because of how early we are in the discipline. Another point I think is important to know about pricing is that the pricing you tend to read in the media is not exactly what makes it to a pharmaceutical developer. And it's not exactly what's involved in the handoff between a provider site and a pharmaceutical developer and a payer. For example, there's government-mandated discounts that can be anywhere from 17% to 23% of the cost of a product, whether it's through Medicaid channel, 340B discounts. Those are just some examples of some of the costs that come off the top when you're launching a product. So there's, I think we do need to take a moment, maybe tip our hats to the degree of Michigas the cell and gene developers are actually tasked with. And the press isn't always exactly what it looks like, you know, at the point of care or when you're actually looking at the books at the end of the day. A separate point that I think is important as well to, in the context of pricing and value is that right now there is some degree of infrastructure where payers can kind of get around costs, if you will, where provider sites can be at a loss. So especially if you're dealing with an inpatient administered product, let's take, you know, the Medicare or Medicaid channel, you usually structure reimbursement around a DRG. And that's intended to be a bundled rate for product and services. And for a lot of the standard care that those have been applied to, DRG rates tend to be released at least 2 years after an episode of care, sometimes a little bit later. You know, it started to become more common, and there are these set amounts. Now, different DRGs have been applied to cell or gene products if you're offered in the inpatient settings. That's a required reimbursement structure. But of course, our treatment journey for cell and gene products and naturally the price point, as we just talked about, they do not fit within the bounds of a given DRG. Even the DRG that's been developed for CAR T, it's far below the list price of product alone, much less the work it takes a hospital around, you know, cell collection and product handling and, you know, AE mitigation or things like that. So sometimes there's a question as to whether or not a provider site can be made whole. And there's a lot of sophistication that's needed in your reimbursement going back and forth with Medicare and Medicaid to make sure that you can be whole as a provider site. So the dollar flow, if you will, around cell and gene products is quite complex in its own right. And there's a lot of different places for leakage. So hopefully that's helpful context as a different way to think about the price points that have come out. And, you know, also maybe some inclinations around what we could see change in a future state as some things become a little bit easier to manage, like the cost of making product, or the extent of duration of a treatment journey as we get better at handling them, or side effect profiles change for later generation cell and gene products.
Yeah, sure. And I think too, you know, whether it be subject matter experts who write really thoughtful guest columns for Cell and Gene or subject matter experts that I talk to in the space, much like yourself, really knowledgeable and informed professionals, echo your sentiment that, there's a, these are, yes, on the surface, very expensive treatments, but there is there's a lot of context to your point to go, what looks like a, to go with along with that price tag.
Very well said.
Yeah, I think you're in very good company with your outline there. But what I on the kind of the flip side of that though, given what we just talked about pricing and value, what do you expect to evolve to better support affordability of offering cell and gene therapies to patients?
So I think from an affordability perspective, I'll actually take this toward the provider side and the patient, because I think that's where a lot of question or concern around can I actually enable access to this product tends to sit today, and rightfully so. The given that, as we just talked about, adequate reimbursement for provider sites has been an issue from the beginning, frankly. It's great to see now there are payers or states that, frankly, that are starting to recognize that traditional reimbursement models like DRG-based payment can't naturally be applied to cell and gene therapy. So you're seeing some Medicaid states like California, Massachusetts, they're carving out cell and gene therapy reimbursement from other legacy reimbursement rate structures like transplant, so that it can start to eliminate some of that question that comes about when you are applying a legacy DRG to a category that it really doesn't fit well with. I am really hopeful to see that continue to take hold across the country. Medicaid in particular is a very high need channel, and having that type of recognition really streamlines that relationship between a provider and the payer, right, locally, to enable access to a lot of those higher need patients. Additionally, I'm very hopeful to see the innovative payment model setup start to evolve. Currently, for innovative payment models, they're difficult to action on for many reasons. Since for these contracts, it does require that payers allocate resources to track cases. They have to follow up sometimes with patients and providers to collect medical information. They may have to pull or analyze claims data. So you're allocating, at least a specific person to track something over a period of time. It may not be worth the investment for the number of patients that you could, or the extent of potential savings you could have to invest in that type of infrastructure as a payer for innovative payment models when there's this fragmentation in patient volume across payers. But as we get more products into the space and more patient cases into the space, hopefully that dynamic will start to shift where the operational burden becomes more feasible. And the other thing I think that will be helpful with that, so we talked about, innovative payment model development, so more of them, right? Increasing patient volume that may sit with a specific payer. And then on top of that, claims-based endpoints. Those can be very helpful for innovative payment models. It eliminates some of the back and forth that could be needed as a payer between, with a provider, with a patient, especially if patient healthcare moves to a different payer. So, that's going to be based on the FDA label and the indication, but connectivity with claims, based endpoints will be really helpful to see that move forward. And then I think the other point here as well, from a patient affordability perspective, right now for the transportation, like flights, lodging, meals, car rides back and forth from where you're staying to a hospital. Provider sites sometimes have programs or financial support of that. Advocacy funds, especially in different rare diseases, can sometimes provide financial support. Some payers will provide financial support for some components of that journey. And also, pharmaceutical developers provide financial support for that. I would definitely like to see more involvement of payers or clarity around covering some of those steps. But provider sites and advocacy groups, manufacturers have done a very good job at kind of amending or adding on to what may be available to help a patient caregiver move through that treatment journey, especially if it's a longer duration treatment journey up front.
Good. Okay. And that's really good to hear. I'm glad those opportunities exist and that the patients are, they don't have to search for that information, that it's readily available. Okay. Why do you think cell and gene therapies have felt a strain in obtaining adequate investment dollars in the last few years? Do you think it's going to turn around?
Yeah. It's definitely a difficult question. There's been a lot of question around this. I do have a perspective. I think that, compounding on the biotech strain that followed the healthcare boom, frankly, during COVID, cell and gene products have faced further issues in part due to, I think, an overall kind of lack of understanding as to why some of these earlier launches have had issues hitting forecasted opportunity as early as expected or at a pace that was expected. And, today we have not only discussed operational dynamics that maybe need to be amending forecasts, but also hopefully shedding light on the implications of under-resourcing for commercial planning and preparedness efforts, right? So, part of that really can come in with communicating with investors what that commercial plan can look like upfront, right? I think there is a gap in understanding of, mapping what that path to launch truly means, what are risk mitigation plans being put in place, and how would you expect your product to differ from market precedent? Right. So in those investor discussions, providing context behind, what has happened with other launches? Why do you see this, the differences in ramp up than maybe you've seen in other therapeutic categories outside of cell and gene? And what is it that you are doing to either prepare for that, potentially mitigate it, or maybe your product structure is totally different and some of those challenges that were faced do not apply to your product, right? And kind of teeing up that story. I think, for example, a product that has side effects that are more easily managed in an outpatient setting, similar to standard immunotherapies, those products will have an opportunity to see much broader, faster adoption in a community channel, potentially, versus what we're dealing with in today's market, right? It starts to move away from having concentration of treatment at very specific sites. That can make a huge difference in time to ramp up, right? They'll all still face maybe sensitivity around reimbursement, but then you are diversifying where patients can go. It's going to be more affordable to get to those sites. They may be able to stay with their existing provider. And that could be a very strong value story for investors, right? If that's a dynamic that's applicable to your product. I think hopefully, and maybe out of this podcast, we'll increase awareness of some of the issues to move the needle there. But I am hopeful to see as well, payers and provider channel experience evolving in the cell and gene category will also hopefully streamline some of the access and utilization barriers that have been in place with the earlier wave of products.
Good. Okay. We're kind of coming to the end of our conversation, but before we wrap up, I do want to talk to you a little bit about what do you think the industry needs to be more focused on to improve access to cell and gene therapies in the long run, especially given the clinical promise that they do offer. What are you most excited about for the future of the sector?
Yeah. I mean, clinically, we're only scratching the surface of what's possible here. But on top of that, I am really excited about next generation products having the lesser degree of side effect profiles that can enable much broader access to patients for these products. Our healthcare system also wasn't built around one-time high-cost therapeutic journeys like this, right? So starting to evolve how that works and seeing the movement from Medicaid states recognizing it, I am really hopeful that that starts to transition as well. And maybe we even see some change in the Medicare reimbursement channel. And then, we're also very far from standardizing manufacturing approach, cell types that are used. There's a lot of room for innovation there in manufacturing. Another big thing I'm really excited to see actually is we haven't seen breaking into the immunology category just yet. Immunology is going to be a very interesting one to take on because it's a category where historically, especially in bigger disease areas, we've kind of pushed patients to start on older mechanisms of action. And also, the treatment journeys end up just cycling patients through a lot of expensive therapeutics for years. So while I think the pricing in immunology is quite different, like the total cost of care comparison that's ultimately going to be made, compared to oncology, it's a little bit different. They may not be deadly disease states, which can that you know those are likely to be impediments to growth, but it's such an improvement potentially on the overall quality of life for a patient and how often they can not be in the healthcare system, right? Move away to having a life that maybe they could be drug-free for longer periods of time. That would be incredible. So I'm hoping to see momentum come, as we transition to a market that's maybe more toward cure, if I can jump to that, and less reliance on that frequent dosing for patients. And then, I mean, as we talked about earlier, I am hoping to see more movement and investment in the cell and gene channel. There's just so much opportunity here. And, hopefully we'll start to see greater understanding in that sector of what the challenges have been with prior products and the degree of promise that's really held in this space, moving forward.
Good, good. Well, thank you. I echo all of your sentiment there too. I feel like we have nowhere to go but up, and progress, continued progress for sure, in all areas of cell and gene therapy. So yes, I echo your sentiment totally. All right, listeners, that wraps up this episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast. Thank you to the Dedham Group's Jen Clarer for her time and insight. Jen, thank you so much. This was an exceptionally informative episode, and I am very, very excited for our listeners to glean just an immense amount of information from it. So thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you again for having me.
Absolutely. All right, listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we will talk to you soon.